When I was 30, Megan and I were visiting New York City, and for the first time I had the opportunity to leisurely stroll through Central Park and really experience the delights of its bridges and glades and ponds and forests. It had existed for years in my imagination, rather as a legend shaped by films and books like every Woody Allen movie, Ghostbusters, and Hair. Much like in the difference between any real sunset and the photo in which you tried and failed to capture even half its grandeur, the experience of the park in real life was frankly astonishing. As luck would have it, while later pillaging a bookstore near Lincoln Center, I happened upon a new volume from Witold Rybczynski, entitled A Clearing in the Distance, which encapsulates the working life of the man known for having designed Central Park, Frederick Law Olmsted. Good Christ, I merrily blasphemed. This is just about all right. I became enthralled with Olmsted's story, and not just because he wore a fulsome beard and dressed like a bucolic patrician whom one might encounter sipping beer at the Prancing Pony. Rybczynski's book was so engaging that I embarked upon a run of some of his other excellent works, such as Home, The Most Beautiful House in the World, and One Good Turn, A Natural History of the Screwdriver and the Screw. These excellent volumes are in the non-fictional vein of some other writers I would recommend, such as Bill Bryson, Elizabeth Reut, John McPhee, and Mark Kurlansky. Olmsted's life story was splendidly rich and full of surprising tangents, considering that the singular accomplishment of building Central Park would strike me as plenty to get done in a productive lifetime. Once I decided to write about the man, I was lucky enough to spend a day touring Central Park with some experts. Park historian Sarah Cedar Miller, senior landscape architect Steve Bopp, and Director of Preservation Planning, Marie Warsh, all leading members of the Central Park Conservancy. As we canvassed the park's 843 acres, my three guides were able to point out fascinating bits of history, as well as new developments in landscaping, park upkeep, and restoration projects like the obelisk. I was quite impressed by the passion these three invested in their work. They truly seemed to be in love with the park. As just one example of the myriad treasures housed in Central Park, the 69-foot, 220-ton obelisk, also known as Cleopatra's Needle, is the oldest man-made object in Central Park and the oldest outdoor monument in New York City. It dates from 1450 BC and was made erect in the park on January 22, 1881. Yes, like a boner. A time capsule buried beneath the obelisk contained an 1870 U.S. Census, the Bible, Webster's Dictionary, the complete works of William Shakespeare, a guide to Egypt, and a facsimile of the Declaration of Independence. A hall of which I think Wendell Berry would approve. See Chapter 9. Also, a small box was placed in the capsule by the man who orchestrated the purchase and transportation of the obelisk. Obviously a Freemason, he will probably remain the only person in history ever to know its contents. That is, until I unearth the capsule and the climax of my upcoming Nick Cage film, National Treasure 23. Immanentizing the Eschaton. I should mention, without further preamble, that Frederick Law Olmsted was actually only one half of the design team working on the park. His estimable partner, Calvert Vaux, really gets the short end of the stick when it comes to being credited for their gorgeous collaboration, a fact made quite clear to me by Sarah Cedar Miller. Fans of Vaux are quick to point out with little humor that we have him to thank for many of the pastoral masterpieces within the grounds of the park, but his name is rarely mentioned when Central Park comes up in conversation. Given the expertise of my triumvirate hosts and the meticulous work being performed day in and day out by the Conservancy, I was in no position to argue. Let it be known, therefore, that Calvert Vaux, an incredible architect and artist, got the shaft. Let's get back to Olmsted, whom I was to learn was responsible for so much more beauty on this continent than Central Park. In fact, they created Brooklyn's Prospect Park, which they considered their masterpiece, during the construction of Central Park. His park designs were amazing, and they continue to enthrall the public today. But Frederick Law Olmsted's path took some interesting turns before he arrived at those opportunities. As a boy in the 1820s and 30s, he attended a boarding school in Connecticut that was operated on a model that I think could truly benefit the youth of today. The students would spend the day chopping firewood, hauling firewood, tending the fires, and otherwise maintaining the school buildings and surrounding farm grounds. And only then, when the chores were done, would they participate in classes in the evening. This sounds to me like the perfect school for churning out great Americans, for besides arithmetic and spelling, the pupils were being taught character and the value of a work ethic. Put it all together, and what do you get? A Frederick Law Olmsted. I think this brand of matriculation must have been especially effective for Olmsted, since he described himself thusly. I was very active, imaginative, inventive, impulsive, enterprising, trustful, and heedless. This made what is generally called a troublesome and mischievous boy. How's this for gumption? Young Frederick threw his plans to attend Yale out the window when he suffered the effects of sumac poisoning around his eyes, weakening his vision to the point that he decided not to trouble his blighted orbs with collegiate studies. Where does one encounter poisoned sumac? In the woods, of course. The moral of this story? If you spend enough time in the woods, you won't have to go to college. He tried his luck working in a silk shop to no avail. He despised the 12-hour days, 6 days a week, but the shop was near the harbor, where he caught the bug to be up in the crow's nest, giving the sailor's life a try. At an apprentice sailor's paltry wage of $5 a month, he could not have been more miserable sailing to China, thanks to seasickness, hunger, and thirst. Life on the high seas quickly lost its allure, and he determined to take a swing at a vocation decidedly more earthbound. With his father's help, he acquired a farm, first in Connecticut, then at a second spot on Staten Island, where he became obsessed with scientific agriculture, curiously exploring new avenues of horticulture and animal husbandry. A new breed of journal aimed at these new scientific farmers who could read, unlike traditional farmers, were like a 19th-century internet chat room for inventive agrarians. Poring over the periodicals, constantly attempting new crops, sustained by new and experimental fertilizers and methods, Olmsted began to write letters to these magazines, like The Cultivator and The Horticulturist, literally digging into his newfound vocation as a commercial farmer. He experimented with seaweed as a fertilizer. When New York City's market saw an overabundance of peaches, he switched to pears. He wrote to a friend, "For the matter of happiness, there is no body of men that are half as well satisfied with their business as our farmers." While he was cheerfully embroiled in his farming efforts, an obscure Scottish novel came through Olmsted's lively rotation of titles, Sartor Resartus. The story concerned a German philosopher with a dissolute youth, which resonated with Olmsted, who was unable to achieve a sense of blind religious faith, ditto. According to biographer Justin Martin, the philosopher's ultimate conclusion was something like, "All is chaos, and one's only option is to construct meaning as best as possible through work. And not just any kind of work, but rather work that has helping others as its stated goal." This philosophy struck a chord with Olmsted, one that would eventually lead him to find his true calling as the father of American landscape architecture. Despite his valiant efforts, Olmsted's farm could not be made to satisfactorily bear fruit, as it were, so he ultimately gave it up. His ever-supportive father then sent him on a walking tour of England at the tender age of 28. Young Frederick was constantly reading and keeping notes of his life's endeavors, and this British ramble proved no exception. He kept a detailed journal of British farming innovations, as well as the beauty of the countryside and some lovely parks, Birkenhead Park in particular. He noted, "What artist, so noble, with far-reaching conception of beauty and designing power, sketches the outline, writes the colors, and directs the shadows of a picture so great that nature shall be employed upon it for generations, before the work he has arranged for her shall realize his intentions. Enjoying his parks, I have often had precisely the same admiration for the artistic foresight of Olmsted himself, albeit with somewhat less eloquence." Man, he sure thought this up dope. This park is slick as shit. By the time he was 30, he had published Walks and Talks of an American Farmer in England, adding author to the growing list of trades of which he was a jack. Although it was considered a rather slapdash work, the book contained enough observations to fill some 700 pages, signifying an appetite for language and an apparently tireless writing hand. This penchant for hard work, along with his interest in the slave economy, led to an interview with the New York Times. The Times wanted him to tour the southern American states for some months and report on the true state of slavery, a hot issue of the day that sparked a great deal of opinion in the North, but opinion backed up by little tangible knowledge of the actual state of affairs in the slave economy, knowledge that Olmsted was hired to glean. If at first Olmsted's qualifications seemed lacking for such an assignment, the perceptiveness of his selection by the Times soon shone through. He had been a farmer, and he had written a detailed report of English farming and her countryside whilst carefully touring the country. This new assignment wanted to be a very similar feature article, with the addition of a particular focus on slavery. Olmsted took to it like a tabloid to celebrity cellulite and managed to interview several slave owners who had also experienced running farms in the North. This farmer-to-farmer discourse allowed our intrepid reporter to deftly run the numbers involved in the efficiency of farm productivity with and without the use of slavery. His findings were quite elucidating, showing conclusively that a slave accomplished about half the work a Staten Island hired hand could achieve. In a manner of speaking, Olmsted's report clearly proved that, in addition to its obviously onerous qualities and the level of human rights, slavery also just didn't make sense economically. As a farming system, it contained myriad inefficiencies in both labor and production. This unique criticism, based solely upon his empirical observation, made an influential splash among the members of the abolitionist movement, whose appeals were more emotional and purely sympathetic. Olmsted scientifically proved that because of the dehumanizing nature of the work a slave was required to perform, there was very little initiative for that oppressed person to make use of any gumption. And without gumption, the half-hearted labors cost the slave owners money. As these observations were gradually published, the southern plantation owners naturally came to be aware of the negative appraisals therein, making the southern climate decidedly less friendly for Olmsted. It took a lot of grit to continue reporting on what had become a very moral issue to him, but it paid off handsomely. His dispatches were widely praised in the United States and overseas, where he had made fans of great thinkers like Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin, and Karl Marx, among others. When he eventually published the collected pieces in his book A Journey in the Seaboard Slave States, he won accolades from the press, like this from the New York Post. "This remarkable book is certainly the most minute, dispassionate, and evidently accurate description of the persons, places, and social institutions of the southern portion of our Confederacy that we have yet seen." Pretty good for a Staten Island pear farmer. Okay, Let's take a moment to update our Olmsted vocational scorecard. After the brief stint at the silk shop, he made varying degrees of headway as a sailor, a farmer, a journalist, and an author. He'd published 2 books. At this juncture, he was 35 years of age. With such an array of experience under his belt, it should come as no surprise what happened next. Sipping tea at a seaside inn in Morris Cove, New Haven, Connecticut, he struck up a conversation with Charles Elliott, who happened to be a board member on a new project in New York City that had as its objective the creation of a sizable public green space on Manhattan Island. Elliott let slip to our boy that the board would be requiring a superintendent. Despite very little experience to qualify him on paper, as you may have guessed, Olmsted got the job. A little exposition. In 1857, Manhattan was still mostly farmland and pasture above Midtown, peppered by impoverished shanty towns, peopled by immigrants and newly freed slaves, wee stinky hamlets with monikers like Dutch Hill, Dublin Corners, and Seneca Village. At the time of Olmsted's hiring, the land also housed noxious businesses like tanneries and match manufacturers, as well as 2 plants for processing animal carcasses into charcoal filters and glue. Not exactly the ideal spot to place a carousel in an ice skating pond. The foresight of the city planners and ultimately the park's designers in comprehending the fact that before long the urban sprawl would cover the entirety of the island was most impressive. At a time when the actual city covered only the forefoot of Manhattan's stocking, these far-seeing planners had the clarity to name the new space Central Park. The terrain looked nothing like it does today. It had very swampy areas with fewer large trees and more scrub brush. Olmsted oversaw 700 employees who had their hands full draining swamps and removing stones in preparation for the park's imminent construction. Lending an air of suspense to the proceedings was an open contest to win the commission to design this enormous new park. The park's main engineer was a rather uncouth and colorful character, bearing an excellent name for an antagonist, Colonel Egbert Ludovicus Vile. His lack of decorum preceded him, as he was commonly known to employ foul language in the presence of ladies. Most enjoyably, Vile was fixated upon the occult, particularly the conjuring powers of eldritch symbols. I'm not saying this guy was not a Freemason. Vile entered himself in the park's design competition and undoubtedly gave himself a leg up with his intimate knowledge of the intended land features and their existing topography. Meanwhile, Olmsted's crew plugged away, shoulders to the wheel, at the treacherous chore of clearing the grounds for the impending facelift. One portion of the crew was struck down with an outbreak of malaria, while another fell severely and mysteriously ill with fevers and terrible itching. Apparently, they had set a patch of poison ivy vines ablaze in their clearing efforts, the resultant smoke of which will afflict the body just as virulently as direct contact, except the vapors can be even worse when inhaled. I shouldn't have been surprised to learn that some of Olmsted's crew were students about to be exiled to college, thus taking a page out of their superintendent's escape book. The park's commissioners laid down a very specific set of rules and requirements for the design entries, including a tower, a grand hall, playgrounds, and a formal garden, as well as 4 roads crossing the park and a parade ground of 20 to 40 acres in expanse. On top of these requirements, the winning plans would also need to be executable within the dictated budget of $1.5 million. Enter Calvert Vaux. I recommend this title by Francis R. Kowski for more on this underappreciated but fantastic artist. Country, park, and city. The Architecture and Life of Calvert Vaux. Vaux had worked with some of the brass involved in the Park Commission, and had not only previously met Olmsted, but also had read and admired his writing. Calvert Vaux was a talented architect from London, whom one would think possessed all the necessary chops to execute a winning design on his own, but he knew better. It was rumored that the topographical map created by the odious Colonel Vilay was highly inaccurate, a great disadvantage to those hopeful entrants designing features for that particular area of land and its specific peccadilloes. Vaux, the French would say Vaux, but everyone I met pronounced it Vaux, so Vaux cunningly sought out Olmsted, the superintendent of the park, who would likely have an even greater working knowledge of the lay of the land than Vilay. Little could he have known that our Mr. Olmsted was a ready-made, ideal partner for just such a design project. Well-schooled as he was, in all varieties of planting, and particularly obsessed with trees, of which they would need thousands. Beyond his acumen as a farmer and landscaper, Olmsted possessed two further qualities that proved to dovetail perfectly with the talents of Vaux: common sense and gumption. The duo relied on their clear foresight to understand that the winning park design should, above all, maintain its integrity for generations to come. As Olmsted wrote, "Only 20 years ago, Union Square was out of town. 20 years hence, the town will have enclosed the Central Park. Let us consider, therefore, what will at that time be satisfactory, for it is then that the design will have to be really judged." Another important factor to recommend their design entry was simply their sense of taste. Thus, they chose to flout the hodgepodge requirements set forth by the board, which paid off in a design that was all of a piece, putting the other, more eclectic designs to shame. In the final decision of the competition board lies a very satisfying lesson. Olmsted and Vaux continued to fine-tune their design until the final day, fussing at such length that the contest office had closed by the time they arrived with their submission. They were able to hand it off to a janitor and hope for the best. Despite their tardiness, despite their disdain for the prescribed requirements of the competition, among 33 submissions, theirs was the clear winner. By a tally of 7 first-place votes out of 11 commissioners. The lesson I would like to draw from this sequence is as follows. If you don't like the rules as they apply to your art, then break the rules. This won't always work out in your favor, as it also requires a degree of perspicacity on the part of the adjudicators. But if they are able, as Olmsted and Vaux's were, to look at the broken rules and say, "Oh, this is better. Why did we make that dumb rule?" Then taste and good design can win the day. Before proceeding, I must make mention of another humorous and sad entry in the competition. A certain envelope number 2, which contained only a single anonymous drawing of a pyramid. It was roundly held that this curious offering could only have been proffered by Colonel Vilay, who was later laid to rest in a pyramidal mausoleum of his own design at West Point, no less. Now, I am definitely not saying he was not a Freemason. I can't help but think that the winning twosome found the path to victory through a great talent for design in nature, sure, but also their insistence that this park be used for the good of all, in as humanitarian a way as possible. "It is one great purpose of the park," Olmsted pronounced, "to supply the hundreds of thousands of tired workers who have no opportunity to spend their summers in the country a specimen of God's handiwork that shall be to them, inexpensively, what a month or two in the White Mountains or the Adirondacks is at great cost to those in easier circumstances." Touring Central Park with my esteemed guides lent a great first-person quality to experience the intended effects of the designer's intentions. Before we even entered, Sarah pointed out that each of the park's 18 different entry gates has its own special name. As designed by Olmsted and Vox, carved into the stone wall next to its specified opening. Openings, I should point out, for which wealthy New Yorkers requested grand ornate gates like those found in the urban parks of London and Paris. Olmsted and Vox instead opted for low sandstone open gateways to symbolize an accessible city refuge open to all comers, rich and poor alike. The gate names themselves have a charming sense of working-class history and creativity. Artisans, artists, engineers, farmers, hunters, mariners, merchants, scholars, and woodmans. Also observing the disparate gender and age strata of the day, there were gates marked boys, girls, and women's, as well as one marked children's. Apparently, 19th-century anthropologists had not yet unearthed the mystery of what sorts of creatures comprised children, namely boys and girls. The Women's Gate, located at 72nd Street and Central Park West, is very convenient for reaching Strawberry Fields, but it must be a bummer, particularly for women across the park's expanse on the Upper East Side, to have to walk all the way around the park to access their gate. Perhaps someday women will find a loophole by tricking men into hiring them as miners or scholars, so that they may more easily enter the park from numerous other points. On a more poetic note, there were also gates assigned to more figurative groups: All Saints, Pioneers, Warriors, and my favorite for the enigmatic image it evokes, Stranger's Gate. Located at 106th Street and Central Park West, the Stranger's Gate opens immediately onto a wide slate staircase that leads one upward into a shadowy pass between stone bluffs beneath the romantic canopy of hornbeam and black cherry trees, as though by ascending the steps you are stepping into a fairy tale. Clearly designed as the preferred entrance, should Aragorn, or Strider if you prefer, ever step out from the pages of Tolkien and into the park from Central Park West, which, oh-ho, also happens to be known a few blocks to the north as Frederick Douglass Boulevard. Watch me tie this entire son of a bitch together. My guides from the Central Park Conservancy fervently explained the methods by which the park had been entirely man-made, much the same as Disneyland, except it had been built with stone and soil and trees and shrubs. In excavation, it reportedly required more gunpowder than the Battle of Gettysburg. Olmsted and Vox wanted the public to begin to experience the park immediately upon entering, again, just like a Disney park. I suppose I should be thankful that I can enter Central Park without being accosted by a person dressed as a giant mouse. To achieve their desired effect, the landscape artists ordered a great deal of modification in the elevation of the pathways. Using hills, valleys, walkways, and bridges instead of paints and clay, the duo created what Sarah Cedar Miller insists was the greatest work of American art of the 19th century, an estimation I am disinclined to dispute. In fact, Olmsted and Vox openly stated that their goal was to fabricate a three-dimensional version of a painting like those of the Hudson River School, with the then innovative new style of presenting scenes of nature with romantic realism. Another defining quality of those with gumption often seems to entail getting the trappings of progress out of the way and letting nature do the talking. One of the philosophical bents aligning Olmsted and Vox on the same artistic path was a penchant for serving all classes of people with their park. Like any successful collaboration, they each had their specialties within a shared overall aesthetic. For example, Vox designed the park's structures like the storybook dairy, originally intended to serve as a refuge where children could enjoy a fresh glass of milk warm from the cow. The safe practice of pasteurizing milk had not yet come into use, and New York City was lousy with nefarious purveyors of dirty milk that had been thinned out and cut with fillers to stretch out the cellar's supply. The dairy provided a type of official milk dispensary where your little nipper could freely slake his or her thirst in the nurturing bosom of Central Park. Olmsted, on the other hand, specialized in sculpting what he referred to as passages of scenery, meaning the meadows and glades that showed off his extraordinary gifts. He developed a signature hourglass shape to these features, making the open area narrow in the middle, then flaring out at each end to create a sense of narrative. As Justin Martin surmised, someone standing in such a meadow would be naturally drawn toward the narrow middle. It presented an allure and a mystery. What was on the other side? After walking through the passage, there was a release, like walking through a tunnel into a stadium. Another of my favorite plebeian victories scored by the designers was in the egalitarian nature of the pathways themselves. Auguste Belmont, of horse racing fame, was one of the park's commissioners, and he insisted that the finest sections of the park should be serviced by carriage roads and bridle paths so that the wealthy would be favored in viewing the scenes. Olmsted and Vaux nipped that idea in the bud by ensuring that all the most pleasant vistas and grottos were accessible only by pedestrians, so that citizens from every class could use the park with equal opportunity. Despite their primary focus on beautifully choreographed natural scenery, some buildings and bridges were required. Olmsted insisted on simplicity, but Vaux was able to have his way with a few exceptions, most notably the Bethesda Fountain, which remains an absolute masterpiece to this day. I was taken aback when my guides pointed out to me the beautifully intricate stone carvings in the structure all around the fountain and pavilion, telling the allegorical story of the four seasons of the year in accord with the seasons of a human life. The reason for my shame was that I had visited the fountain many times without fully noticing these gorgeous and painstaking details. It was a valuable lesson in letting one's vision fully relax from the information of the busy world when enjoying the park and the works of Olmsted and Vaux. It harkens back to the quote that began this chapter, that a surplus of information creates a paucity of attention for features like the fountain. Perhaps my former myopia just means that I'm more of an Olmsted man. Trees and a waterfall for me, thank you very much. During the 12 years of construction that the park required, a little skirmish known as the Civil War broke out. In those days, the reason a park would feature a parade ground was not for public parades like the one Macy's throws every Thanksgiving. Parades of that stripe require streets. No, the parade ground in a park was designed as a large open field in which military divisions could assemble and drill, both for practicality's sake and for public display. Olmsted despised the thought of his open meadow being used as a utility of wartime, for, as he asserted, the park was designed to serve as a refuge from such unpleasantness. He and Vaux wanted the worries of the world to be left behind when a person strolled into their park. Imagine, then, his delight when he and the park administrators elected to populate the parade ground with a large flock of sheep. The sheep proved to be too much of an inconvenience for the soldiers, but caught on immediately with the public and became a permanent fixture for many years, so that since that time the parade ground has been known much more pastorally as the Sheep Meadow. A stone building was constructed on the west end of the meadow in which the sheep would slumber at night. This building eventually became a pub and restaurant that is still open today, called Tavern on the Green. To see their combined vision realized, Olmsted and Vaux slogged through countless battles with the park commissioners and the corrupt politicians of Tammany Hall, not to mention each other. At one point, Olmsted grew so aggravated that he fled the city, indeed, he fled the eastern seaboard altogether, to oversee a gold mine in California, and then took part in an early commission to convince the government that Yosemite should be preserved indefinitely by federal funds. Rubbing elbows with our old pal Theodore Roosevelt in their mutual epiphany that the government should be urged to preserve the most spectacular instances of wilderness in the West, Olmsted became one of our first outspoken environmentalists. His Yosemite Address of 1865 was instrumental in getting that particular ball rolling, stating, "The establishment by the government of great public grounds for the free enjoyment of the people is thus justified and enforced as a political duty." He eventually had to be coaxed back to New York by Vaux, who dangled the carrot of a new park commission, this time in Brooklyn. Newly inspired by his travels in the West, Olmsted envisioned a small ravine and waterfall in what became known as Prospect Park, to mirror the epic splendor of Yosemite. Once again, the team had to completely fabricate the sense of a partially wooded, hilly terrain that would seem as if it had always been there. One specific display of gumption on the part of John Collier, a lieutenant of Olmsted's through many chapters, was his invention of a tree-moving machine that had the ability to grasp the tree trunk near its base and pull up on it like one pulls a weed. Apparently, enough of a root ball would be retained to allow the trees to survive being moved to new locations. This allowed some of the more magnificent old growth to persevere, a most worthy cause indeed. By that time, Olmsted and Vaux were able to exert enough influence to build this park closer to Olmsted's crafted wilderness ideal, although it must be noted that Vaux, for all his love of Victorian buildings, made this his personal credo. Nature first, second, and third. Architecture after a while. In Prospect Park, they together achieved a masterpiece considered by many to be the pinnacle of their careers. Today, as then, both of their New York City parks boast picturesque bodies of water, upon which one can inexpensively row a boat in the middle of a bustling metropolis, preferably with a loved one nestled in the stern, referring to the aft region of the boat, not the beloved's anatomy. That fact alone makes them a most charismatic destination in my book. Is that redundant? One note of contention, however, that forever rankled Vaux was that Olmsted had been awarded the title of Architect-in-Chief at Central Park. I suppose his ire stands to reason, since Vaux was officially the architect of the pair, while Olmsted had no formal training in that field whatsoever. Although this was representative of the rancor that colored much of their time together, they still shared a mutual artistic passion, anchored in a deep bond of loyalty and respect. All well and good as long as they weren't required to see each other for more than a few minutes at a time. Even so, Olmsted always humbly recalled that their partnership was Vaux's idea to begin with. "Without him," Olmsted remarked, "I should have been a farmer." On the domestic front, Olmsted had rather fallen into a marriage with his brother's widow, Mary, after the untimely death of his brother, John. With the widow, Olmsted also inherited a pair of sons in his nephews, Owen and John. Apparently, he felt the stringent guidelines under which he demanded his parks be shaped were also appropriate for the formation of young men. In an endless upbraiding, a form for which he was famous, his resignation letter to the Central Park Commission logged in at 41 pages. Olmsted admonished the headmaster of Owen's boarding school with incessant instruction, detailing all the skills he thought imperative in a young man's matriculation, including to saddle and bridle a horse, to ride, drive, pack, clean, feed, bleed, and physic a horse, to rescue drowning persons, to ford a river, to kill animals without cruelty, to preserve meat, to make slight repairs in and run a steam engine safely, to preserve clothing from moths. While Colonel Roosevelt, as well as one Ron Swanson, might have heartily approved of these directives, it's hard to imagine a school conducting some of this curriculum without losing a few of the runts. But perhaps that's just exactly where the source of Ron and Theodore's rugged preference would lie. Despite Olmsted's attempts, his other stepson slash nephew and employee, John, also turned out to be a bit of a ne'er-do-well, as evidenced by a couple of poignant and typically interminable letters to the lad. On his way to tour Europe, John probably had just enough time on the ship crossing the Atlantic to read the instructions sent along by his stepfather, Uncle Frederick, writing that was to be read over and committed substantively to memory while at sea, reread in London and again in Paris. Olmsted veritably deluged him with guidance, with lists of parks, castles, cathedrals, and estates that John should digest, as well as scores of acquaintances of Olmsted by whom John might meet with some advantage in knowing. Above all, his stepfather urged him, "Everywhere examine closely and accurately all small architectural objects adapted to park work." Seems pretty straightforward, right? I wouldn't think he needed to go into further detail. Wrong! Pavilions, lodges, entrances, chalets, refreshment stalls, bridges, conservatories, plant stands, fountains, drinking fountains, lamps, flagstaffs, seats, railings, parapets, copings, etc. As though John would see a chalet and not realize it would be included under the heading Architectural Objects? All this, and Olmsted still had to add etc. to the end of the list? Isn't that Latin abbreviation usually employed so that one might curtail a long list? It turned out that our sweet Frederick had some control issues. In 1874, Olmsted received a commission to design a park for the Canadian city of Montreal. In 2014, I met Daniel Chartier, who served the resultant Mount Royal Park as the chief landscape architect, early one morning at a coffee shop at the base of the city's small central mountain, where he whipped out an 11-by-17-inch book, the thickness of a Chicago Yellow Pages. Ask your parents. I had been steered in his direction by Central Park's Sarah Cedar Miller, and it turned out that she could not have turned me on to a more ideal Olmsted freak. Mr. Chartier, a trustee of the National Association of Olmsted Parks, NAOP, was an absolute treasure trove of Olmstedian lore and philosophy. He walked me through the massive book he had compiled on the history and ongoing development of the Montreal Park, and I was nothing short of delighted by his enthusiasm. After so much reading of the dusty history of these historical figures, it was so refreshing to feel the heart of Frederick Law Olmsted beating with a robust rhythm in a living person. Daniel, quite excited that this strange, bewhiskered American wanted to know anything at all about the man who had inspired his own life's work, began to fulminate, in very enjoyably broken English, my French is for merde, about Olmsted's legacy. "A park is for more than air and exercise, it is poetry," he insisted. Olmsted understood the charm of natural scenery, the genius loci. Please make sure that is in your book. "Done, sir." This phrase, meaning genius of place, combined with Mr. Chartier's passion, brought Olmsted home for me in a way that I hadn't previously considered. It also happens to be the title of another one of my excellent sources for this chapter, Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted by Justin Martin. Much the same as my wife, an exquisitely talented interior designer and goddamn bombshell, can look at a room and conjure, with a few pieces of art, a rug, a love seat, and a couple of throw pillows, a work of such aesthetic genius as to astonish a clod like myself, Olmsted was able to look at a raw park site and envision just particularly the way it should be shaped, the specific story that could be told there in such a way as to bring the utmost pleasure to the visitor. As Mr. Chartier pointed out to me, Olmsted had an elemental knack for the richness of his work's narrative. He comprehended on an almost animal level the value in a lovely open space viewed through the trees, a glade or a clearing in the distance. When we as a species lived in the woods, open space brought with it a sense of freedom and safety, because there could be no lion or tiger hiding in that open space. Stands to reason. Daniel continued to regale me with the tastiest of exposition as we began to hike up the mountain. His fervor, as we passed beneath a beautiful canopy of old and new growth, confirmed a suspicion that I had long harbored. One could land a lot worse employment than to work in parks and recreation. As we meandered up the main road for a spell and then cut straight up the hill on a rugged, rambling path, he pointed out the places that Olmsted's vision had been realized, as well as places it had been shortchanged. "A park is a work of art," Daniel proclaimed as I looked around me with a reverence that made it hard to disagree. The long-term protection of a work of nature and art like the Park of Mont Royal requires sustained dedication on the part of those responsible for its stewardship. There needs to be a constant process of education at work by which each new generation of citizens comes to learn about the value of Mont Royal and the design that Frederick Law Olmsted created, wrote Dr. Charles Beveridge, who is considered the greatest expert on Olmsted and his work. After enjoying the generosity of Sarah Cedar Miller, Marie Warsh, Steve Bopp, and Daniel Chartier, and seeing the good work they have done and continue to do, I couldn't agree more. Chapter 7. The Diplomat. Eleanor Roosevelt. Hey, it's a woman! There are a great many Americans who deserve to be heralded for their gumption-riddled careers, patriots and trailblazers of one ilk or another, for whom I had not room in this book. Many of those excluded are women, beginning with Pocahontas and Sacagawea, Abigail Adams, Martha Washington, Dolly Madison, Betsy Ross, Lucretia Mott, Jane Addams, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and surprisingly, Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, who reportedly, according to Sam Houston, had a fetching holster. Look it up. Here is an original thought that I just had, and you can feel free to quote me. History is written by the side that didn't lose. That means that most of the history of Western civilization maintains a focus commensurate with the patriarchal domination of society, including a particular emphasis on the achievements of military and sports figures. Reading our histories, one can begin to wonder if there were even any women about, excepting the amount of coverage Miss Crockett received for her heroic contributions at the Alamo. Judging by my own sturdy family in Illinois, or even the household of two that I share with Megan Mullally, the scarcity of recorded female influence upon the history of our population until the last century or so is a lot of bullshit. The women running the nation of my life, mainly my mother, her late mother, my aunts, my wife, and many of my stage managers, directors, writers, teachers, castmates, and woodworking peers, just for starters, have been powerful and gentle and beautiful and strong and vital. The long misrepresentation of what used to be known as the weaker sex is an egregiously offensive load of malarkey, perpetrated by chicken shit men, like me, who were afraid their own contributions would somehow be diminished if they admitted to collaborating with ladies. We'll tuck into that topic more substantially, but I wanted to mention it up front as we dive into the First Lady of Gumption. Eleanor Roosevelt was born in 1884 to a family of swells who were extremely well off financially, meaning she didn't necessarily have to pull herself up by the straps of her lady boots, at least at first glance. However, although she and her family could afford the niceties of life, she experienced a poverty of another color, because she considered herself an ugly duckling in an era when physical beauty was somewhat relied upon to determine a young lady's eligibility. In addition, she lost both of her parents and a brother by the time she was 9, adding depression to her already blossoming insecurity. She was thereafter raised in the household of her maternal grandmother, where she recalled her grandfather forcing the children to walk from the house to the road and back several times a day, with a stick across their backs in the crook of their elbows to improve their carriage. He was a severe judge of what they read and wrote and how they expressed themselves. The result was strength of character, a certain rigidity in conforming to a conventional pattern. Eleanor saw the positive effects of this training, as well as the downside of strict conformity, and she found her escape in reading, another voracious reader, anything she could lay her hands upon, which proved to be tricky. Apparently, when she came upon subject matter that was beyond her knowledge and she asked the adults about it, the book would suddenly disappear. Note to parents, there is no better way to make your child crave a forbidden item than hiding it away from them. She would spend days hunting down the concealed books, which I imagine would be considered pretty tame by now. For example, she remembers it occurring with Dickens' Bleak House. Good God! What I wouldn't give to get my nieces to take a break from the Bieber chat rooms, or One Direction, or whomever the cute boy pablum of the moment might be, and read some Dickens. Her grandfather Hall enjoyed the advantage of wealth that had been amassed by the hard-working previous generations of the family, so he did not feel the need to work himself. Eleanor wrote of the great lesson she observed when the family grew lazy in laboring to maintain their good fortune, and then watched that surplus slip through their fingers over the course of a couple of subsequent generations. Interestingly, she saw her relatives buckle down and reacquaint themselves with the ability to work hard for their bread, just as their forebears had once done. It always amuses me when any one group of people takes it for granted that, because they have been privileged for a generation or two, they are set apart in any way from the man or woman who is working in order to keep the wolf from the door. It is only luck and a little temporary veneer, and before long the wheels may turn and one and all must fall back on whatever basic qualities they have. This sentiment seems terribly poignant to me today, what with the vast gulf that continues to grow between the wealthiest class of Americans and those who are working in order to keep the wolf from the door. When those who grotesquely profit from our corporations continue to grow financially fat by selling unhealthy products to the masses, or by overcharging us for pharmaceuticals, or by outsourcing so many millions of jobs that could be performed by staunch American hands, they seem to be forgetting that we are all in this together, and eventually they, or their children, will be made to rue all those flavors of corn-based snacks. The niece of Theodore Roosevelt must have begun to sense some of his dowdy nature in her own genes. Discovering her individual mettle through trips to the fields or woods, where she would completely forget the passage of time by escaping into her reading. By the time she was 14, she had begun to sense that one could perhaps succeed without being considered the greatest beauty. As she then wrote in an essay, "No matter how plain a woman may be, if truth and loyalty are stamped upon her face, all will be attracted to her." Sounds like Dickens can do a body some good. Her confidence grew a great deal further when she was sent to Allenswood Academy, a private finishing school near London. Her instructor, Marie Souvestre, was a noted feminist thinker who encouraged her pupils to learn foreign languages and think for themselves. Souvestre taught that one should experience other cultures as deeply as possible by enjoying their food, art, and local customs but most importantly by understanding and speaking their native tongues, because of the enjoyment you missed in a country when you were both deaf and dumb. These lessons would prove extremely instrumental in Eleanor's future as a diplomat, with the vision to see all nations as one collective of people, rather than as opposing teams in the grand arena of world politics. Although her confidence was bolstered by her teenage schooling, Eleanor was still very much a Vestal virgin when it came to canoodling. Remember, this was at a time when using a person's first name was considered the equivalent of a French kiss today. One did not allow a man to kiss one before becoming engaged to that man, at the risk of being considered an absolute slattern. Despite her high-minded clumsiness, Eleanor wrote, "I felt the urge to be a part of the stream of life, and so, in the autumn of 1903, when Franklin Roosevelt, my fifth cousin once removed, asked me to marry him, though I was only 19, it seemed entirely natural, and I never even thought that we were both young and inexperienced." Eleanor and Franklin proceeded to move into a townhouse connected by only a sliding door to the residence of Franklin's mother, Sarah, whom, it should be noted, was outspoken in her opposition to their union. Although the young couple produced 6 children, Eleanor did not feel well suited to motherhood and was overshadowed by her mother-in-law in the child-rearing department. This arrangement, in which Sarah openly commandeered control of both households, was miserable for Eleanor, and most likely her husband Franklin as well, but nobody possessed the gumption at that point to stand up to the overweening matriarch. Despite the apparently fecund marriage bed that produced those 6 kids, Eleanor sadly disliked having sex, stating to her daughter Anna that it was merely an ordeal to be born, which makes me very glum. It's tough enough these days, what with the kids casually hooking up, for 2 lovers to be honest and trusting enough to engage in sexy times that will satisfy both of their appetites and leave no feelings of inadequacy or vexation. Imagining the awkwardness of engaging in stiffly mannered copulation 100 years ago, when it was considered indiscreet to even sign a letter with any other sentiment than very sincerely yours, makes me shudder with discomfort. Despite her best intentions, Eleanor was somewhat out to sea when it came to child rearing. When I was young, growing up in the cornfields of rural Minooka, Illinois, our parents had the luxury of letting us run wild out of doors. My dad's whistle was so loud that we could hear him call us for dinner time even down at the creek near our house. Playing innocently in the sun, we had no idea how modern our lifestyle would have seemed to young Eleanor, who had a curious arrangement out one of her back windows for airing the children, a kind of box with wire on the sides and top. I knew fresh air was necessary, but I learned later that the sun is more important than the air, and I had it on the shady side of the house. She slowly but surely learned to cook, eventually regaining some sense of control from her mother-in-law. When her husband, Franklin, was stricken with polio and lost the use of his legs, Eleanor finally won an extended battle with Franklin's mother by convincing him to stay in politics and therefore remain vital and active, for his own sake as well as that of the nation. While vacationing in Fairhaven, Massachusetts with the children, she realized that her young boys no longer had a mentor in the realms of adventure and sport, like swimming, fishing, and camping, and although she was not a swimmer herself, the onus was upon her to literally swim or else sink into the role of insufficient parent. Eleanor faced the music and wrote, "I would have to become a good deal more companionable and more of an all-around person than I had ever been before." Once she got a taste of succulent independence, Eleanor Roosevelt began to comprehend how her life could be much more satisfying. She began to remain unavailable to her older relatives and in-laws, upon whom she had theretofore depended for advice in every aspect of life. As she put it, "Had I never done this, perhaps I might have been saved some difficult experiences, but I have never regretted even my mistakes." As tragic and life-altering as FDR's paralysis must have been, I can't help but also see it as the catalyst that made an American hero of this previously timid housewife. Eleanor also noted that Franklin's illness proved a blessing in disguise, for it gave him strength and courage he had not had before. He had to think out the fundamentals of living and learn the greatest of all lessons, infinite patience and never-ending persistence. "I believe that's two lessons there, Mrs. Roosevelt, but I'll let it slide this time." As the governor of New York and then the president of our nation, Franklin Delano Roosevelt could not have provided his wife with a better role model for sagacity in leadership. She often noted the way in which he, being no expert in any particular field, would calmly hear all sides of a given problem before issuing his considered judgment. She also observed the success he enjoyed in canvassing his electorate so thoroughly that even the remotest farmers felt his attentions. Every president, especially in modern times, is going to have his or her, fingers crossed, high points, and then also those other kinds of points in which they, oh, I don't know, assume office despite receiving fewer votes than Al Gore. FDR must have been doing something right since he was the only president to be elected into office 4 times. Invigorated by cheating death by polio, Roosevelt instituted a set of programs that he called the New Deal, designed to bring relief to a very depressed United States. His various policies were very effective in bringing about relief, recovery, and reform, at least until the politicians mired his decency once again in, well, politics. His was a great legacy, one you can read about in even more depth than my 3 recent, deeply researched, resplendent sentences. He was such a badass that he has been portrayed on screen by John Voight, Bill Murray, Kenneth Branagh, Jason Robards, and of course Alan Cumming in Reefer Madness. Eleanor also took note as Franklin developed a talent for gleaning a great deal of information through simple observation during his campaign trips. "From him, I learned how to observe from train windows, the crops, how people dressed, how many cars, and in what condition, and even the washing on the clothesline." She continued to report that her husband was impressed by the evidence of our wastefulness, our lack of conservation, our soil erosion. Now, this was 1932, mind you. I can't imagine what the Roosevelts might think of the sad, cold, monocultural state of our agriculture today. This habit of cropland scrutiny was perpetuated by Eleanor for the remainder of her career as a diplomat and humanitarian. In all her travels, she paid special attention to a nation's farming habits and how they affected the health of that country's population, both bodily and economically. Her husband's example, combined with her own burgeoning interest in people from every walk of life, culminated in her manifestation as a true activist for world peace and tranquility. Although she was always quick to denigrate her own gifts, there was no denying that Eleanor, once she had escaped her mother-in-law's nest, was busting her ass. During her husband's tenure, Mrs. Roosevelt wrote a syndicated newspaper column, My Day, no less than 6 days a week, even while touring the South Pacific, even when she had to stay up all night to get her column turned in. She typed out this prolific diary-style feature